Today's episode is with Lissy Turner from the Yoga Shack, which is just outside of Byron. She's a yoga therapist. But you may know her if you're of my vintage and a Triple J listener like I was, because back in the day, Lissy Turner was Mel Bampton. And Mel had a morning show on Triple J called Mel in the Morning. She also did the drive shift with Charlie Pickering, and she did an incredible project called the Producer Series on Triple J. I was a huge fan of her, and in fact, she inspired me to leave behind my terrible job in sales and embark on a dream of working in radio. And she contacted me last year to see if she, you know, to learn a bit about what I was doing with Radcasters. She was thinking about starting a podcast. And we connected and we had this chat on the phone, and it was just like two people who had known each other for a million years. I just totally connected with her, loved her to bits, and then realized she was Mel Bampton. So I was really interested to get her on to talk about this change that has occurred for her over the last 10 or so years, going from a person who was so in the music scene, traveling all over the world, speaking to some of the world's most famous and most amazing musicians, to running a yoga business with her husband and having a brood of children and living a life very different as Lissy Turner to what she did as Mel Bampton. So I'm really excited to share this episode with you. I hope you dig it as much as I do, and I'm sure you will. Let's dive in. Introducing Lissy Turner. Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
I'm going to start from where I am right now this week, because I think this week where I am will bring it all together, I hope. So I'm in this really interesting week this week where I've decided to take 2 weeks off. I'm still doing a few bits and pieces here. It's impossible to take 2 weeks off. But as an atmosphere, as an approach, I'm giving myself some time to actually finish a project that's from my former life that still exists in this current life. And it's been plaguing me for a very long time, this project. It's actually 7 years overdue. And I haven't been ready for lots of reasons that I can't quite articulate at the present moment, but I haven't been ready to get it out. I haven't been ready to finish it. And all of a sudden I woke up in the night a few days ago and I was like, I have to get up and work on this project. So from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., I stayed up and I worked on a book that I was commissioned to write by HarperCollins.
I was actually going to ask you if it's a book because I heard I'm 2 years into writing a book, and I've heard the average time it takes to write your first book is 7 years.
Wow. Well, I think I'm actually about 10 because I think they gave me about 3 years to write it, extended my contract, and now I'm 7 years overdue. So I'm going well over the average. But it was for so many reasons, but a big one was that during the middle of this contract for writing this book, my life took a big lateral step. This book is about, based on a series that I made for the ABC and for Triple J many, many years ago. And the series was long standing. It ran across about 9 years and it was called the Producer Series. And that involved me traveling all over the globe and interviewing or searching for some of the most prolific music producers there were in the world and some of the biggest bands and biggest albums that they worked on. So this documentary radio series itself took an awful lot of time in my life just for on air. And then after it was finished, I was approached by HarperCollins ABC to write it as a book, more like a travel memoir / compendium, and put it together with a lot of the behind the scenes stuff of that journey, you know, a lot of the, which seems to be more of the shame, the bad behavior that was going on by myself behind the scenes, but also just a lot of that commentary that you obviously don't make whilst you're sitting there in deep dialogue with an interviewee. So I had essentially brought it with me when I moved from down south. I was living about 3 hours north of Sydney at the time of getting this book contract, and I moved back up to the Northern Rivers with the intention of finishing the book in that year. That was my goal, is to stay very focused, just me and my two children, and write this book and get it off the table. I had been here for about 3 weeks, and I'd gone to a friend's place for a dinner party, and her, being the clever little Cupid that she is, also brought in another old friend of ours, had invited him over, someone who I hadn't seen for 10 years, but had known in another lifetime. Anyway, he came, and before you know it, we'd hit it off, and a relationship formed between him, a single father. He had his children full-time at that stage when we met, and I had my two children. And there was that very strong connection, just as two parents doing this thing on their own. And so it was based more in that deep connection, deep supportive sort of role, but very quickly became a much deeper loving relationship, which essentially, that was 8 years ago now, through my whole everything, my year's plan to finish that project out the window. We were bringing together five children at that stage. Wow. We moved in together maybe about 6 months into the relationship, and so there was all of that navigation of the blended family, and then a whole lot of life happened during that time. Probably the most substantial and most difficult living that either of us had ever done, for many, many reasons, which I have a feeling you and I will traverse over the next little while. But it was interesting that this week, this book resurfaced as something that required completion. I'm such a completionist, like it's really necessary for me to complete things all around the house, whatever it is. And this large thing had just been sitting there, unable to be finished for reasons of time, but also emotional reasons for taking this big lateral step that I mentioned earlier. And then here we are, here I am this week. I've got it pulled out. I've actually got it printed out. It's right here, my manuscript. For the first time, I've printed it out to actually physically mark pen to paper. Got the red pen out yesterday and all day just doing it on that next level. Because the thing is about it is it's actually virtually complete. There's probably only a week left of work on that book, and that's been like that for the last 2 years. Sitting there with only a week's work to go.
So often we have that stuff hanging around us though, right? Like whether it's the book, I remember I don't know if I'm a completionist, but I went to university to study arts because I didn't know what to do with my life, and got to the last two units and got sick, and so just never went back. And I feel like there was a time where I wanted to go back and complete it so I could close the door on it. But then, anyway, that's a big long story in itself. The university wouldn't have me back. So it was kind of left
a cruel blow.
I know, so I was kind of left open. But so often we have these things that energetically are kind of, we're still tied to our past in some way because we haven't closed the chapter. Like, and in your case, it's like a literal chapter.
Which is crazy though, anyway, because these are all self-imposed, self-constructed ideas of closure. And the call for me with this book completion, though, feels much bigger. And it wasn't processing. It wasn't like, oh, well, that was just a great exercise to do. That really honed a lot of your writing skills. It taught you a lot about these different things and about your own internal processes. There was more to it than that. And it's risen again very, very strongly. And I really feel, because it is the cork. This book has been sitting there like the cork that's holding back a lot of the stories that need to come behind it. And I thought many, many times of just putting that book aside and beginning the new ones. But I just felt like if I can't complete one, how will I know that I can't complete any? So this one feels more like that now. And funny, it's so funny reading it, because it's written by Mel Bampton, which is my radio name from before, when I was Mel in the Morning and did my whole life at, or had my whole life at Triple J. I'm stepping back into that world, which is something that I've obviously been trepidatious about for a little while, because my life has been so in my yoga journey, so in my family, yes, sorting out all of that stuff, getting that all grounded, that I obviously wasn't in a place where I could straddle comfortably the two worlds, even though I obviously had to have, I have had to do that over various moments when Mel Bampton has been called back to do radio duties or festival duties or whatever, as part of the music industry life, but they've been very few and far between. Yeah. Whereas now I feel like, obviously now, without really any thought, I feel a lot more grounded in both to be able to bring the two together finally. I don't know how that will look in the long run.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, you're just speaking my language, because I felt like a similar thing. Not that I had – well, I did. I think we all have these – I don't know if it's part of aging or this stage of life that we're in, but – I've definitely felt like there's been a couple of versions of me. And for me, I was diagnosed with depression in 2009. And that was really a marker in the sand for me, because I went from this party animal who drank a lot, went to a lot of live gigs, took some drugs, had a lot of fun, to this person who was way more spiritual, did a lot of work on herself, and got to know who I really was. But then there was still this gap between the two that I just couldn't bridge, if you know what I mean.
Which and is I'm really crazy, sure, because it's just substance to substances in a lot of occasions that's really the only gap there.
Yes.
But they consume so much and they come from a much deeper place. You know, when there's been a lot of partying, they obviously distort a lot of the mind function. And we do need to level a lot of that out before it flows more harmoniously with who we have become and who we are continually becoming. And I completely understand that. And I'm not sure that the unity is quite there yet, but certainly the direction, the flow of direction is much more unified than it's ever been before. And I did a very similar thing where I think I must be coming up for 6 or 7 years clean now this year. And which seems ridiculous even to phrase it like that for me, because when I was in the midst of it all, that was just what everybody did.
Yeah.
Like, that's the music industry, the entertainment industry.
Yeah, it
that's
wasn't
actually
like you had
just
a problem.
Most people's lives.
It was just,
no,
you know, part of your life. Yeah.
If you didn't do it, you had a problem.
Yes.
You know, like that was
totally.
That was the reality. And so it wasn't really where I went all of a sudden, oh, this is not good, I shouldn't be doing all of these things, I'm drinking too much, even though, you know, I had children and whatnot. It was all normal and I was highly functional in all of that, which I think sometimes is more dangerous, because we just can keep putting one foot in front of the other. But then circumstances with the children and the whole tug at the mother's heart that children are so good at doing, that started to change the priorities. That started to actually tug on me to change who I was deeply within, because those behaviors, even if you're highly functioning, they're not giving your children you at your fullest potential. You know, a hangover is never the best frame of mind to be in to deal with the patience required for loving parenting. And then my daughter started to get into a whole world of trouble. That took us down a road that we never could have foreseen in terms of its intensity. And so what was being asked of me was to be more. I had to be more. I couldn't still straddle this world of being, you know, a half or a three-quarter even version of me, because my child, who was going into her teen years, was experiencing things that required all of me and did so for many years. It was very tiring. Thank God she's 21 now, but my goodness. And I mean, that all of that stuff was a blessing, of course, in terms of how it transformed me. And that's the one thing I really hit home with a lot of other mums who I see in clinic for yoga therapy, that who have got daughters who are really challenging them, is that it's just to really reassure them how wonderfully they will change you, how wonderfully the teenage daughters particularly will change you, change the mothers to become, because if you don't change, if you don't evolve, you are screwed.
Yes.
and they will force that within you, like this burning process, and you can either be burnt up into just this kind of lifeless charred, or you can become – this diamond of it as much as you can be, that's been, you know, broken into a million pieces by that process of parenting and then put back together in the most wonderful ways.
Yeah.
A friend absolutely. Of mine actually wrote, I saw a quote on her Facebook page recently, which I love. She just had her third baby and she said, having children, first they break you and then they make you. And I was like, oh, that's so beautiful.
And break you they do.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
But you have to get back together again because you have to support them in that. And we went through quite a long time with her of that horrible not knowing whether they're going to survive or not. Is this child going to make it? Like, really? And then some nights we were like, has she not made it? Because we don't know where she is. Has it happened? You know, days of not
and
knowing.
And as a mother, it's something that, like, I don't know if this is for all mothers, but it is for me. And it may be just my conditioning. My mum is just a wonderful, nurturing mother. When she was maybe 9, one of her friends got run over in front of her and head cut clean off. And just, like, so from that point, she's obviously carried a lot of worry and concern and has lived her life in fear of losing people. And
yeah. And
so that's obviously had an impact on me. And then I look at my daughter and it's my greatest fear. Like, I can't even contemplate that place of, you know, yeah, of losing my child. Like, it just is something that, yeah, it just breaks my heart to even contemplate it. I just can't even go there.
And it's so the natural fear, but yeah. It's also potentially the most destructive.
Yeah.
In terms of what we can bring to them as mothers.
Yes.
So yeah. Restrictive. And in reflection, when I was this journey with my daughter, there was so much reflection over and over and over again about every moment in her life. Had I done this differently? I was like this. All of this self-torture, and it's not over yet. We're certainly vastly out the other side in terms of those processes for me, but it's not over. Until she's really, really on her feet will I find that peace. But in reflection, I could see all of a sudden how much fear had governed my choices as a parent and created so much unnecessary tension in our lives because I was so afraid of losing her. I remember when she was born, I was only 21 when she was born, and that feeling that we all have with the first child and, well, the vast majority have with the first child and being so almost floored by this tsunami of emotion and thinking all these people leading into this, particularly being a young mother, have given me, you know, every bit of advice under the sun, told me all of this and whatnot, but no one had prepared me for this emotion of incomparable love that was unlike anything that I'd ever experienced before, and I was completely and utterly unprepared for and overwhelmingly terrified by. Mm. Oh. I have never been so scared as I was from this emotion. I knew I could do the task. I knew I could raise this child, even if everybody around me at the time was like, oh, my God, this trash bag, single mother, 21-year-old with green hair and piercings all in her face and, yep, I'm having a baby. This is what I'm doing. Oh, my God. Obviously, in reflection, that was probably, you know, not the greatest phone call that my mum received when I told her I was having a baby, and now I can understand why she wasn't like, yay, that's amazing, congratulations. But I knew I could do this. I knew I could look after the child. I knew I could do all the things. But this emotion, my heart was just breaking. I couldn't even look at her without, you know, I couldn't even breathe when I looked at her. And I was like, I'm fucked. I am really, I'm not prepared emotionally for this. And then that love, that intense love, which terrified me, existed as a pattern all the way through, which I couldn't see again until really later in retrospect. Of going, I have made so many decisions around this child's life because I was so afraid of losing her, and she just wanted to spread her wings and be free. And then it's interesting with her journey is that so many of the things that are a mother's worst fear eventuated for her in her adolescent years. And it's impossible to know why, whether that tension of my fear and how that played out on her played a part in those things, or whether that was just always going to be a part of her journey and part of what was required for her growing. But there were so many things where I was just like, as a child, you know, as a young person dealing with these big things, it was like all those things that I was afraid of, all of that, can I handle this pain? If this child ends up in pain, like I used to worry about her being like excluded at school.
Yeah, totally.
You know, that was like, what if she doesn't have any friends? And now I'm dealing with her being abducted from a school bus stop at age 14 and everything that came from that, and going, well, you really have to step up now to what this child needs, because this is like, this is big stuff.
Oh, fuck, yeah.
And then, but then that one thing, and this is what can happen with so many people in trauma, which is why I have such a compassion for people who end up in prison or end up in terrible situations, because people forget in the adults what's happened to them as the child. Yeah. And of course, not everybody takes the same road, but everybody's got a different constitution within and how that will play out for them. But I could see from my daughters that was the first big incident where she was made completely vulnerable and her sense of safety was removed. And then how she responded to that, which was to, in the beginning, initially, it was completely withdraw and very, very strong anxiety for a time. But then it became the other way. Like she wanted to break free of the cage. So it was throwing herself out into the world with abandon. She wanted to spread her wings and come out from underneath the terror. But because she had so much of that fear and vulnerability in her, she was like a flame for the moths. She was attracting in these dark spaces that she was exploring to try and overcome her own fears. So many people, older people, particularly older men, who were there ready to take advantage of that person, of that experience that she'd been through. So it's been a very interesting journey over this time. And I remember once writing, coming back to the book, having to write this note to my publisher when my book was still only about a year overdue, when it was still in kind of reasonable territory, just going, there's no way I can sit down and write this book right now. This is where life is taking me right now. And not going into the full story, but just saying, this thing over here, which I know is huge and amazing project and whatnot, and it's, I understand that you're waiting for me, it's not possible right now. I need to deal with this. And so in place of where the book might have been or anything else, this is where the yoga and the yoga therapy had to rise up underneath, because even though now it's become my whole, it's my working life as well as my spiritual and supportive life, then it was our prop. This was what was going to get us through every day. You know, when you need a bigger picture perspective.
Yeah.
And so it was all born from there. So going back to, you know, telling these mums with daughters who are having a difficult time, just not knowing how they're going to change you in all the best of ways, because if you love them enough, you will change to be whatever they need you to be.
Totally. I have a question, like if we go back to when you made the move, when you decided to leave Triple J behind to actually, I have to thank you because I was an avid Triple J listener back in the day and I loved listening to you.
Thank you.
And yeah, and it's so funny because when you contacted me about podcasting and yeah, and I realized you were Mel Bampton, it was like, it was just a kind of full circle moment for me because I remember driving through the hills, like through, Emerald? Yeah, Emerald in Victoria, driving through the hills as a sales rep in my car, thinking like I was getting good money, working in sales, one of the youngest women in the industry, and kind of killing it, but not really feeling like I was killing it or it was killing me. And I was driving through, listening to you on Triple J and thinking to myself, oh, I always wanted to work in radio. What am I doing with my life? So I went and took a course at Melbourne Radio School. Like this was more than 15 years ago. And I got a job at the shitty radio station in Lismore here for, you know, a couple of years before the egos just really got to me and I had to get out for my own sanity. And I started my voiceover agency and now, you know, podcast for a living. So I want to thank you for just like for showing up as you and, yeah, and giving me a window into what was possible for me. So
I love this story so much because it really reiterates how we have these places in our lives where we're really meant to be, even though we don't know what the effect will be. And because I love radio, I still love it to this day as a medium. I just think it is in this modern world that you can still have a person sitting there a lot of the time, not always, but a lot of the time live on the radio, reporting on events as they're happening, unscripted, and still accessible to the listener. I just find that absolutely incredible and I absolutely loved it. But for me, it came a time for me to go. And just hearing a story like that where then that part of my journey flows on to become then part of your journey.
Yeah.
And I leave that part of my journey and I go over here and I put on this new, you know, it's time for me to wear this new hat over here and you're very much wearing yours. And I just, that beautiful web.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
It's incredible. Like, it's just such a good reminder that we just need to, every time, whatever we're doing, we just need to step up, like to show up first.
Yeah.
And to just step up and be whatever it is that we're doing, just in our fullest potential.
Absolutely. Without any force. We just don't know who we're going to impact in some meaningful way, right?
And so far flung. It could be so far flung, that impact. It's beyond us, which is why in every action, I'm not talking just in a project or this or that or a career, but in every action, if we're always conscious about making every action high quality and just looking at it action by action by action, then of course the sum total of all those actions becomes a high quality life. But then we have the potential to be affecting others with the quality of that action. Not just in, oh, someone's doing this, I might do this, but also if we can be at our highest quality, then that's the benchmark that we also set for somebody else to rock their starting point.
Totally. So because you were living my dream, I'd like to know what was the thing that, like, well, maybe there wasn't one thing, but what kind of happened to make you go, oh, you know, this isn't where I want to be anymore. This isn't how I want to be showing up in the world anymore.
Yeah, I don't think there was really any singular moment. I felt like I had, my life had outgrown Triple J as such. You know, I had two children by that stage, living in Sydney. I don't know how old I was when I left, 10. So I must have been 33 when I left Triple J, which sounds so young now.
It does.
It really does, but it felt like,
It felt like really old. In Triple J world, it is kind of really old.
In Triple J land, I felt like it was time to pass that baton on as well to somebody else. And I could have stayed and followed the same path. You know, sometimes I do think 10 years on from that time, or 11 years now actually, I think, you know, if I'd followed just that one path, I would be wherever I would be within the
working at, you know, RN
echelons of ABC.
Yeah.
Yeah, and loving it, but still most likely in Sydney. The big thing for me is that I really wanted to get out of Sydney, more so than leaving the job. That was pretty difficult to leave, but there are already things starting to come into play about it not being the best life for my children, you know, out a lot, lots of shows, working festivals, lots of gigs on weekends, all of that sort of stuff. My heart was already starting to be pulled away from that. And the big thing was that I just wanted to get out of Sydney. I was leaving my husband at the time in Sydney. That was going to start a whole other picture for me, being a single mum with two kids in Sydney working full time. Childcare back then, 11 years ago, was going to cost me $350 a week. And I was just like, what the heck? That's, you know, more than what I was earning just 5-6 years before for the week. And I just thought, that's outrageous. And so I needed just some time to bunker down with them while all of that family change was being made. And I had a little holiday house up the coast, 4 hours north of Sydney. So we went up there for a little sort of break in between, just to find sort of exactly the word I was thinking of in my mind. And I'm like, I know I won't say that properly. Say it out loud and then you said it. So good. And then so, yeah, like it was a difficult job to leave in some aspects because obviously it was awesome, like awesome job ever. Yeah. And so many fun things and a lot of things that I didn't realize were even attached to it until after I left. And one of them being, you know, that whole look itself where it was like, who am I? I'd been Mel in the morning for the 4 years before that and then I'd been Mel Benson on Drive and I had this identity wrapped up in this job which took me by surprise. I didn't realize how lazy I'd gotten leaning on that as opposed to my own actual personality. So that was a bit of a shock. But, you know, there was a whole marriage breakdown going on at the same time. So there was a few distractions that could keep me away from that. But I kind of love that when all of your cards get thrown up in the air to some degree.
Yeah, and we get to choose the ones we decide to hold on to and let the others fall to the ground.
Yeah, it was very much like that. But I think that process has still been ongoing.
Yes.
Because as I was saying earlier, my intention of moving back up here was to take the year out to be with the family, to be with my children, to be just me and the children, to really heal in a more social place again, because that where we were living was a very small little hamlet and very beautiful, but it was very insular for me and the kids. And
yeah. I lived in Nambucca Heads for a few years, which is, you know, 5 or 6 hours north of Sydney.
Yeah.
And was where I was diagnosed with depression. It just like the isolation just really fucked with my mind.
Yeah,
it can be beautiful towns, but also so many social problems going on and, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I really felt too. It was a lovely place to visit, but it was a difficult place to live, particularly when you were trying to rise up. And that's what I was trying to do, to ground, rise up, but also try and figure out, okay, what am I going to do now? I knew I wanted to write. I was still making the producer series. That went on for another couple of years. I made the Great Australian Album series, so I could do all of that remote, which was a great transition. Then I got involved with Soundwave Festival, and which became a whole other part of my life. But it came time to moving up here. And, you know, the intention was, as I said, to just have that year, finish the book. But no, I fell in love and ended up with this huge blended family and a whole lot of other things going on. But now's obviously the time.
Yeah.
And someone said to me yesterday about the book, they said, you know, because I was like, I can't believe how long it's taken me. And they were laughing that I could have an assignment overdue 7 years. But it's
obviously they weren't the student that I was at school.
Well, it's about, they were saying about books being very much about timing. And I hadn't really been looking at it in that way of being art, because I understand that about art, painting and music. Yeah. And
it feels like it's more subjective or something than writing. I don't know. Yeah.
But it's true. Like when someone said that to me recently, like a few days ago about it, the timing, it just has to be born. And I started to see it more as art rather than this academic process. And it's actually been so awesome, like just feels so good to be in it. It feels so funny reading all these stories about me being shit-faced. Yeah. I'm just like, oh, my God. I did what? Oh, my God. Maybe I should take that out. Should I take that out? And just leave it in there. And maybe that's part of it too, is that now being where so far along this journey.
Yeah, you want to edit yourself into a version that's a little more palatable to future you.
I actually feel, though, now at a place where I'm more comfortable to be with me of the past.
Yes.
So I think that's more it, is that now I can...
There's a level of acceptance that wasn't there.
Yeah, and not feel... I can read about her and not feel like everything that's bad that's happened to my daughter has been because of me having a good time or working, because that was the process for a long time. Every part of my life, like I wasn't even listening to music for years, because when I listened to music, it connected me to my job in the music industry, all those nights at gigs, the drinking, the rest of it, and all of that was attached to this monumental mountain of guilt about where my daughter was at. It's all so connected. Whereas now, like, it's been so interesting. Maybe even a month ago, I couldn't have gotten that manuscript out and read that comfortably. I could have started, but now it's, I can look at younger me and go, that's where I was. And at the same time, I was still always a beautiful, loving, diligent parent. But that reflection on me had gotten lost because one of my children was in so much trouble. And then where, you know, that journey took her in terms of how society pushes down on people when they're vulnerable, I feel is going to lead me to a whole other pathway again.
Book number two, perhaps.
Maybe that's what's behind this one. Maybe that's what's beneath the cork. Not sure yet.
What led you to the yoga mat?
I've been practicing yoga for a long time, since I was 21. So that's 22 years now since I first went to a class, which is actually when I was pregnant with my daughter, and went to an Ashtanga class, and it was awful. Oh my gosh, I swore I'd never ever do that again. I'm lucky, I really feel lucky that I didn't lose my baby actually at that time. It was so inappropriate, that class, and I didn't have any knowledge otherwise. Anyway, it took me a couple of months to recover from the shock of that, of everything in that class, and I found a prenatal class. I went along to that, and that's where I really started to connect to the visualization side, because I've always been so active in my body and a little bit hyperactive potentially, and in my mind is reflective of that too. And the visualization was something that I just really loved. The prenatal was a lot about, obviously, that visualization of baby, birthing baby, a beautiful process, and I think that must have been all very new to me. And I loved moving my body as well, but that's what I realized these decades on. That I think that was the seed that enabled me to stay with yoga over the years and years, where I found what feels true for me on the yoga mat.
Yeah, it sounds like, I just wrote down the word escapism. Like, it sounds like there may have been, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that in your life, you know, in your life as Mel Bampton, there was partying and drinking and all that kind of jazz going on as a form of escapism, and maybe yoga brought you back to who you really were?
Potentially. I think at the time the way that I looked at it more was that it was that and good eating, because I always ate well, that and the yoga. If I was doing those, I could do everything else and stay alive.
Yeah.
So it was more like this ridiculous offset. Oh, it's okay. Look at my beautiful food that I'm eating. Look at this vegetarian meal I'm eating. Well, you know, I take this, you know, pile of whatever it is over here. And so it was a way for me to connect. I think that's always been very strong in me, a sense of health and a sense of well-being and wellness, despite everything. But I also liked the other side. I loved partying. I loved being shit-faced. A friend said to me once, many, many years ago, that I was like an ad for drinking. I made it look so awesome. Not probably one of my proudest achievements. But I really enjoyed that distorted reality. And so maybe there was definitely, you know, all the insecurity stuff that lies beneath that kind of compulsion to drink excessively or take drugs excessively, or that perhaps that sense of disconnection or whatever it is. All that stuff was certainly there, but couldn't be seen until later, until all of it was fading away. And the yoga really just fed that other side of me. And I think they were, you know, very, both very equally strong in me, the party side and the health and well-being side. And I think yoga helped to slow me down. And I notice it still. I just taught a class actually with my husband, and we teach together on Thursdays. It's the only class that we actually teach together. And we've started doing that to make sure that we actually have some time together in the same place. But also because we're about to go to China and teach together over there as well, so we just wanted to have a bit more of that play and cohesion again on the mat. And I see in him, he's so grounded, so steady, like frustratingly steady, like frustratingly enduring. You know, like if you feel like picking a fight, you're just wasting your time on that man. He's like, he's you just cannot be provoked, which for me as a fiery Sagittarian sometimes is really annoying, and but very good, because it wouldn't be good with someone's coming back at you, you know. So he's got this beautiful nature like a rock. And the way that he practices, though, teaches the asana side of yoga, the physical side of yoga, is quite, it's more dancey. It's faster than I teach. And he has a lot more movement in his way of teaching. Whereas for me on the mat, who is the fire, who's more hyperactive, who's 1,000 ideas a minute, my yoga practice and the way that I teach is much, much slower. Because what we should be getting from the mat is in the opposing direction of aggravating factors of life.
Yes.
So for me, that's me on the mat. That's what I need. That's the, you know, stirs that true essence of me. And I completely forget what your question was, because I started talking about yoga, and I can talk about yoga for months on end.
I don't even remember what my question was.
I love it. I definitely love it.
What, so did you, like, when you moved up, were you, you know, you were still working a little bit freelance in broadcasting, or like what led you to go, okay, well, now I'm going to do yoga as my primary source of income?
Yeah, that was a little while away, yeah. So when I first moved up here, the book was the main goal, and I was writing a lot. I was the music editor for Yen magazine, that women's alternative magazine, Yen, doing a lot of writing freelance for lots of different publications. And so that was kind of taking my full-time life, and I was filling in quite frequently for the ABC on the Gold Coast as well. And it really was only after Shane and I came together, where we'd probably been together for maybe a year or so, and we both shared a very strong love for yoga. And then, of course, you come to the Northern Rivers and it's everywhere. Yoga City. But funnily enough, we couldn't actually find somewhere to practice that we really connected to. That probably took a good year. But there was a point where we sat down together with our, you know, five children in our house with a multitude of bedrooms and whatnot, and he was running a landscaping business and I was doing Bampton Media, which was all the festivals and touring and the writing and all of that sort of stuff. And we were just in so many different directions. And then, of course, we're trying to be holy in each of the children's lives. And so we're then in all of the web of their universe. And at one point my head was just spinning and I was just like, this is too much. It's too much. We have to come to a unified path. How can that look for us? What can we do? And it was very quickly apparent that obviously the central thing for us both was the yoga. That's what we really loved. That was our stabilizer in the family. That was the center, you know, and that was also the comfort. It gave us the patience that we needed to be better parents, all of those things, but could definitely bring us to center. So Shane went and he did his teacher training first, actually, and I still really wasn't thinking about becoming a teacher. I didn't know how I was going to fit into that picture, but he was ready. So he went and did his teacher training and became a teacher. And then somewhere between that time and me becoming a teacher, that's when I gave up drinking. And my liver played a very, very helpful part in that, and that all of a sudden could not consume alcohol. There was no strength of will required at all. Because I get asked that all the time, how did you do it? How did you give up and just never have another drink again? It's like, I tried. And if I tried, I would vomit. Like one mouthful in. The very last time that I had a huge bender was actually in Byron. And this is many, many years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. And I could not rise from bed for 2 weeks. My hangover was 2 weeks long, and it was the same every day, throwing up all day, just like the first day. I was watching my children come in to say goodbye to me, to go and do things that my husband and I had organized to do as a family. Come and, you know, give me a hug. Bye, Mum. Hope you're feeling better. And I'm just like, oh, my God. This is from one night out. This is from, and obviously all the damage that came before that. But this was for the fun of one night. And my heart was just breaking in those 2 weeks and thinking, what if this is it? What if I'm not going to get better? What if I'm debilitated like this and I have to process the choices that I've made? And Anyway, so after 2 weeks, it subsided and I was up and about. And so then, of course, we went on this, you know, we must have got, I think we went on a holiday or we did something. And but wherever we were going on our destination, of course, one of the first things we did when we stopped for dinner was we ordered a beer. And, oh, I'm ready now, you know, I've had 2 weeks off, I'm ready. And then I had one mouthful and that was it, ran to the toilet throwing up. I persisted with one more mouthful, same again, straight to the toilet throwing up. And I was like, I'm saying to Shane at this at the dinner table, I'm done. I can't drink anymore. Like I actually
physically can't drink. Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know how I felt in that moment entirely, but I know there was a sense of going, oh my God, like I actually can't. So there's no thought process required. There's no sense of will. There's no fortitude. Just I can't drink anymore. And I was obviously so done by that time. That for me was a huge part of my process to becoming a yoga teacher, because it's something that consistent in your life is so suddenly gone. What happens with that space?
Mm.
And I knew
we're mostly so afraid of that space, right? Like we we can do some incredible things like drinking for however many years to fill that space. And then, yeah. But always I find when we're open to it, something good comes in.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no that space is like opportunity. It's like you've just been handed this enormous bit of real estate and you can do with it whatever you want. And this is what I say to people, because we work a lot in addiction recovery, again, another way that two lives come together. So Shane and I both work a fair bit in addiction recovery, is that the space is real estate that's yours. It's nobody else's real estate, and you can fill it with whatever you want now in the direction, like particularly if to say they're people that we're with out at the Buttery, they're already there making the changes. So use the space or fill the space with choices that are in the same direction of where you're going here by being here in 7.5 months of live in rehab. That's not a small decision. So fill it. And there's lots of things in those programs, live in rehab, that create ideas or give tools to fill that space. So for me, the yoga had to really pour in and pour in a big way because it was such a big space. I got very deeply into the physical aspect of yoga because that's what was required for my very active mind. It wasn't in a state to just sit and be still with itself. So the physical movement is for when the mind is very busy. Then, actually, I turned to Shane one day and I said, I think we should have a baby. We already had 5 children. Obviously, that space was pretty big. I was like, yeah, let's fill it with a baby. We'd been together for a couple of years by then and had 5 children, and there would never, ever, we had talked about it in the beginning, but there was no way that was happening. So we did. We had our, what Shane calls is our 6 and out child. He's our linchpin. And then it was when he was 6 months old that I felt very compelled to go and do my teacher training, because everything was changing again. You know, I still didn't know how, like even when I started my training, how deeply I would go into teaching. By the end of doing my teacher training, which was a month, we built a yoga studio in our yard. So clearly by the end of it, I was pretty committed because we had somewhere to teach and to take all the knowledge that was coming to us to anybody who came.
And so what does life look like for you today?
It's very well. Now I'm a yoga therapist as well. So I've done 3 years of study with my teacher, Dr. NC, who was a student of Desika Charles, the son of Krishnamacharya. He was my teacher ran the Krishnamacharya Yoga Mandaram. He ran the yoga therapy. He was the director of yoga therapy at the Krishnamacharya Yoga Mandaram for 10 years there. And he decided a few years ago, with much coaxing from the head of Yoga Therapy Australia, to come and teach students here in Australia. And I was very lucky to be one of only 3 batches of students that he took on. He's not coming back to Australia to teach that course in that format anymore. He's doing it all from India now. So the yoga therapy, which I won't go into too deeply, but because it is so vast, you know, 3 years of training is a lot more than 4 weeks of yoga teacher training. It takes up a lot of my time now. It takes up a lot of my study time because it's so vast and ongoing, because you're dealing with so many different pathologies. You're dealing with all levels of the constitution. You're dealing with people who are, you know, mildly injured to extremely unwell in the mind, and on all layers in between and beyond. So a lot of time is spent now in clinic with one-to-one students, which I really, really love, and still doing general classes here and there. But now this fortnight where I'm writing this book, feeling compelled to write this book, I feel like there's a strange other coming together somehow. I'm so happy with this writing, like I'm happy when I'm in clinic. It's the same sense of peace in my heart that comes when you know that you're doing the right thing, that you know you've made a good decision, where there's no restriction in the chest at all. And these last few days being having the privilege to have the space to be back in this, I feel that this, the writing is going to have to come back in because it had fallen away during my studies over the last 3 years. So my daily life really looks a lot like taking very good care of my children. I mean, I'm a, you know, I'm a mother with a framework. I'm not just a freewheeling parent who thinks they should do whatever they want. I think that there's that to some degree, but there is a framework here within our home, but a very, very loving and very nurturing one. So I know if I gave my children free rein, even if they completely, even with all the knowledge that they have at this age, being young, if they could choose, you know, a bowl of bloody Fruit Loops, that's what they'd, you know, eat every day if they could. But I'd rather get up and nurture them and cook for them good foods. And like, I put a lot of time now into being a good mother because my daughter grew so fast, and that's one of the most substantial lessons that she gave to us as a family, was that every moment is really precious in the childhood, because the childhood is so cute and it's so beautiful.
And so fast and so long at the same time. When you're in it, it just seems so long. And then when you're looking back, you're like, what the fuck? What? Yeah.
it was such a blessing to have an older child where all of a sudden, like, one's 21, you know, my youngest is 5. She's the oldest, 21, and her childhood was really over by the time she was 11. Even within her, she developed very quickly in her spirit. I remember one day just going, because I was always like, oh, finish this project and then her and I will go and have some solid time together. Then we'll go and do this stuff. Then we'll go and do this stuff. And by then I was freelance running my own business. It was like the spaces between projects is not very peaceful, because it's like,
no. Well, because there's also stress about when the next project is coming from too.
It's exactly right. There's never like, oh, like, I've got a window now, we'll go. It was more like, okay, I'll use this window to generate all of these other projects, so then I'll be at peace. But then all the projects are there, so you don't have the time. So that's what I was doing for about the year before she all of a sudden changed. And then all of a sudden she changed, and that part of little child her was gone, and I missed it. I was there for that time, obviously building our life, and a lot of it was absolutely essential, all of it in the bigger spiritual perspective of things. But on a practical level, lots of it was absolutely necessary. But before I knew it, one day, my God, I was like, that's it. The little girl, without this hormonal flood, she's not here anymore. She's never going to be here anymore. Now it's about making peace with the next stages that will continue on, obviously, until the ends of our life in this lifetime. But it's been such a gift to us as a family that her experience, for me to just go, for now, right now, I'll do whatever I can with my writing, with the yoga classes, with yoga therapy, being asked to travel or do retreats or whatnot. I'll do those as I can as a second priority to being with the kids. Then I have the most peace. Then I can sleep well at night, which is really valuable to me as I've gotten older. It's a good night's sleep.
Yes. Tell me about it. Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like there is, in this world that we live in right now, there is a lot of pressure for us to either be the primary breadwinner, the woman who can do all and be all things to all people. And then there's this other part of us that does kind of, well, for me anyway, that does kind of enjoy motherhood, but sometimes doesn't feel like I'm present in it because of all these other things that are going on. Yet I love both of them. So it's like a, you know, it's like a torn feeling sometimes because I do want both and we're sold we can have both, but sometimes not at the expense of the other.
I think we're living in a really interesting time as women where we are between stages where what came before us was this rising up that was essential, where all of these opportunities in the career world and the political world, the ruling world, let's say, like all that very what we could call the masculine side of things because it's been so male dominated for so long, was women were prevented, oppressed from being part of those larger decision-making forums. That oppression was the issue, not necessarily the role that women had, because they were still in the more important role, being on the ground, being with people, being with family is still the most important one.
Yeah, it just wasn't valued as highly by society.
And it was enforced and it was told. Yes. And if you tried to rise out of that, there was, you know, a cutting down that happened. It was, there was oppression there. And so there was that battle, obviously, that came the generations before us that had, they fought that battle to have access to those things, to break apart the oppression. And then we stepped into this phase of going, this stampede of women going into that space, filling, flooding that space as much as we could because we'd been restrained from it for so many generations, forever. Not forever, because I think back when women would have held a lot more power and things only came about with the church and the government coming together and la la la. But there was this sort of flood of women wanting to get out of the roles that they'd been held in for a very long time. And now we're in this interesting phase where, okay, the doors are open to us, to a lot of that. I wouldn't say equally yet, but very strongly. And I don't ever see women as victims. I think we are so powerful and we continue to rise in ways that is right for women. And I think this is the key now, is that, okay, we've risen to that, but is that direction necessarily the whole of what we want? And I don't think that it is. I think that women can go beyond that. So equality, not meaning same, meaning full power for each, full power for men, full power for women in the way that's right for men and for women.
Yeah, so and for us as individuals too, right? It's like just because we can do anything doesn't mean we have to do everything, you know? Yeah.
And wanting to, I found for me, and this was a large thing that I found when I was reflecting on my daughter's childhood, that I really struggled to be the domesticated mother at home because I felt that was wrong. I actually thought that was wrong for the women who'd fought before me. And as a strong woman, I thought it was wrong. And so much damage was done for me with that viewpoint. So much damage for my daughter was done because of that viewpoint. When it took me a long time for me to find my peace in the strength of being a mother, and that the mother is the number one. That is the one. That is the strongest of all the dharmas, all of the purposes is being mother. In that is every single bit of suffering, every request for fortitude, every request for love and patience that you could ask for in any spiritual arena. It all exists in motherhood. And this love that connects us to these children is so strong that we don't have any choice but to follow that path. Otherwise, everybody hurts. And this was, and now, like, I guess it's taken a long time, and I feel it in the women around me who've just really risen up in this way to be mothers if they want to be, work when they want to be in the way that they want to work, do whatever they want to do, but in this full power. This is not down here, like it was so, as you said, like, it was looked down upon. How outrageous. How outrageous.
And in some ways still is, still very much is. I've had girlfriends who chose to leave work and be neck deep in motherhood. I can't tell you the amount of other women who have harshly judged them. Like, what do you do with your days? What do you, like, don't you have dreams? Don't you have? And the thing is, like, these women have fought for our right to be able to choose.
Yeah. And that's what was or can be lost, I think, sometime in those conversations or those judgments, is the right to choose. That's what women were fighting for. They weren't fighting to be necessarily the chairperson of the board of directors. That might be the goal for some.
To have the choice as that, to have that as an option should they decide that's the path that they want to take. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now it's a time just to, I think it's a really interesting time where both men and women are looking, obviously we're all always individuals, but looking what are the inherent qualities, the masculine and the feminine of them, which we both have. We have both the masculine and feminine within us, which is what makes us such unbelievably capable and complex creatures. But if we look at the inherent qualities, if there are any, of man and woman, and at the end of the day, if we can see what those are, maybe we can have a little bit more patience and understanding with each other. My friend of mine said to me once that so often as women, we just expect we think of our men just like big, hairy versions of us. So we get really frustrated.
Yeah.
But when I talk to my female friends about their frustrations, the frustrations are nearly identical.
Yeah.
That the husbands don't see all the little details, that they're not good at managing the whole house. They just, and whether that's conditioned or not is irrelevant right now.
Yeah.
Right now we're having this problem. And whether that can change over time, where the qualities become more and more meshed, I don't know. But right now, what are, if there are any, inherent qualities of man and woman so we can be more kind and patient and understanding with each other? And then how do we allow those qualities to rise to their fullest potential? And then amongst that, when we break it down for the individual, what decision brings the most peace to your heart in terms of what you're doing with your life? That's it. Got nothing to do with anybody else and anybody else's judgments. What brings peace, that lack of restriction in your chest, when you're doing the thing that you believe is your purpose?
What an incredible note to finish on. I was going to do the whole, takeaway and all that kind of jazz, but we've really just summed it up perfectly.
What a journey. I think you and I can talk for days.
Absolutely. Let's do it again. Sometime soon. Well, thank you so much.
This has been such a pleasure.
It feels like a full circle moment for me. So thank you for showing up as your divine self. And and thank you to the universe for connecting us. I'm eternally grateful.
And me too, Carly. It's been really, it's such a fun out thing when you just have to sit down for a moment and just talk about, the buffet of your life. And it's interesting what can rise on any day in those conversations as the important thing in that moment. And I'm glad you've got me at this crossroad moment with my book and my yoga life, because it will be a good reference point for me in a year or 2 years coming back to this conversation and where it led me.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about this medium. That's what I love about podcasting is it and radio. It captures a moment in time, and I've thought about for me, there's two versions of this show, and one is when I walk on the beach and just talk to myself. And I've been doing this now for nearly 3 years. And if I look back to me 3 years ago, the person who I was is different to the person that I am today, just the same way Mel is different to Lissy, it's like, We learn and grow and evolve, and having captured that, that those magic conversations that we have sometimes with ourselves and sometimes with others is, why I do this. And this is the thing that brings me peace. So, I'm so grateful that you could join me for a piece
of peace. My pleasure. Well, there was just one more thing on that.
Yeah.
Something that one of my teachers said to me, that his teacher said, when you're uncertain of your purpose, this is a great little tip. When you're uncertain if you're on your path or not, just ask yourself, if you knew it would come with no money or no glory, ask yourself the question, would you still do it?
Yes.
Then you know.
And that's my answer. Yes.
Yes.
Classic.
Oh, thank you, Carly. Again. Thank you so much. I hope that wasn't too self-indulgent.
No, it's never too self-indulgent. I love it. Thank you.
It's really a lot of talking about yourself, isn't it?
But see, this is the thing. Like, often we don't get that opportunity. We're rarely given the opportunity to do that. And so it's kind of cathartic in a way. And also then you're like, oh, my God, what the fuck did I say? What is this thing going to turn out like?
That's probably the real reason why I left radio, was those nights of going, I can't believe I said that out loud. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I remember saying something sometime that ended up in the Senate, like, and I was just like,
oh, my God.
I was like, I think I need a break from this. It's just a bit too stressful. I couldn't be trusted. I wasn't, you know what it was, is that I wasn't yet at my authentic self.
Yes.
And so when things were coming back at me, like if criticism or things like that, where it would actually end up like in Parliament, something that I'd said on the radio, and it caused me this sense of distress, I started to look at why. Why is it distressing me? And I realized it was because I wasn't really true to who I yet was. I was just saying things for the sake of entertainment. A lot of it was an imprint of who I was.
Yeah, but it wasn't not you showing up as your full potential of you, your best version of you.
Yeah, which I don't know if any of us really are in our 20s, but but I could feel it. I could feel like I needed to find that before then I could speak wholly again.
Yeah, maybe because it's like we've grown the roots of the tree and the wind, you know, we kind of become unshakable when we're in our true authentic self. The wind just kind of moves our leaves, but it doesn't blow us over. When we're not, then we're easily blown off course.
We can't stand up for things that aren't true to ourselves. So when people are attacking us about them, it can create all kinds of inner conflict. But, you know, it's like that great word, unfuckwithable. When that is the case, when you are really honestly believe purely what it is that you're saying, it doesn't matter what comes back at you because you know in your heart that it's right for you.
Totally.
And that was the feeling I had in Triple J for a long time, this feeling of unease in my chest. And a lot of it was like, I mean, I never really said too much controversial. I mean, I said shocking things as jokes, but I didn't talk a lot about very heavily opinionated things unless it was part of that guest's agenda. But still that feeling that,
like, you could be exposed at any moment or...
Yeah. Particularly when I was working with Charlie, because Charlie was such a pain in my ass. Oh, my God. I mean, we're so close now. I mean, we rarely speak, but we're like brother and sister. You know, I just love him. I love him like family. But back then, I just, everything about him, this preppy white lawyer. You know? And I was like from Triple Z. And that was my kind of background. I was so punk ethos. And then I'd have to laugh at things he'd say. And if anybody liked our show, I'd feel like there was something wrong with them.
I liked your show, but I liked you. Not that I don't like Charlie.
But you changed so much too.
But you brought the groundingness to it or something. I don't know.
I was the bogan. He was the preppy white lawyer. Anyway, sorry, I'm going to go pick up the kids.
Yeah, no worries. Well, thanks so much.
All right, darling. Have a great afternoon. Lovely to talk to you. Bye, Carly.
Hey there, are you rad as fuck and have a couple of extra bucks in your pocket burning a hole that you would love to give to a fellow rad as fuck human being who's creating an incredible shit hot podcast called Carlosophies? Well, my friend, you are in luck. What will you get for the few bucks burning a hole in your pocket right now that you would generously throw towards me? Head to the website patreon.com/Carlosophies and you'll see there's a stack of rewards and extra behind the scenes stuff that nobody else gets. I would absolutely fucking love your support. So head to patreon.com/Carlosophies.